Hello, I'm Debbie Mackey.
And I'm Alan Mackey. We're your hosts here on Left of Liberal, a program, and we also have a Facebook page.
The Facebook page is also called Left of Liberal. There are several on Facebook, so look for the White Peace Poppy. We have a contact number at 512-517-2708. You can also email us at leftofliberal@outlook.com.
One of the main reasons we have undertaken doing this program, Left of Liberal, is because we feel very strongly peace and disarmament are central to most working class issues and form the basis for pulling together a massive, broad-based all-people's front comprising liberals, progressives, and leftists, and many other people, irrespective of class. But the left, oriented towards working class issues, focused on anti-imperialism, is going to be the catalyst in educating and organizing this all-people's united front for peace and disarmament, for equality and social and economic justice, with socialism on the table now, not later.
And you can listen to our program every Monday at 7 p.m. Central. Also, you listen to Stuart Alexander's program, Socialists Can, 1 Hour Left. It's on Wednesday at 8 p.m. Central, and there'll be a program this coming Wednesday. Also, we have a meeting August 10th in Austin. You can find that information on Socialist CAN, Connection Action Network. Consider joining that group, and the meeting will be all day on August 10th. So consider signing up for that so we know how many people are coming. We have a guest today, Darrell Rankin. He's a leader of the Communist Party of Manitoba. He's long active in the peace movement and organizer of solidarity with the people of Sudan. Darrell has been a Communist Party candidate for provincial and federal offices. Darrell is also a frequent contributor to the People's Voice, the publication of the Communist Party of Canada. And I just want to say welcome to Left of Liberal. And can we begin by you giving us a background and history of Sudan and where it's located, Darrell?
Sure. Thank you, Deb. Sudan is one of the largest countries in Africa. I think it's the third or fourth largest country. Recently, the southern part of it separated with an international recognition of its government in the south. It's located in the eastern side of Africa, near the north, around Ethiopia, Somalia, and that area. It's precisely south of Egypt. The River Nile connects the two countries, Egypt and Sudan. A bit about the history. It's a land of about 40 million people. It came out of colonial control in 1956. The British were the colonial masters of that country for many, many decades and underdeveloped it, deliberately cutting off huge portions of its territory, like southern Sudan, for that reason, creating all kinds of divisions within the country. Many of the problems that Sudan has today are inherited from the colonial past, underdevelopment, comprador capitalists, meaning like the capitalist system that they have is very much integrated to the extractive industries of the Western world. The powerful and wealthy countries, i.e. the imperialist countries. So that's a bit of the history of the country itself economically, but politically it's been a very long history, a remarkable history of three very important uprisings of the people in the 1960s, 1980s, and now this third one where there were really revolutionary movements that threatened to upset the imperialist apple cart to free Sudan from the chains of imperialism.
Maybe you can explain a little bit about why and how South Sudan became Sudan and South Sudan.
Sure. Sudan had a lot of resources in the southern part of its territory. The people there saw an opportunity to have an independent country of their own, and they received support from certain powerful countries outside of Africa as well. The current regime in Sudan, well, essentially the same one now, but it's the al-Bashir clique, if you will, that ruled Sudan for the last 30 years, alienated the people in southern Sudan. It was one of the many areas of Sudan where the Bashir regime oppressed the people in the different provinces. So the South felt it was justified to leave. They have a different national identity, and it was a matter of self-determination. It was a democratic choice of the people of Sudan to leave, but also they were encouraged by countries like China, with whom they have agreements to export oil from their territory at this point in time.
So the like South Sudan has a pipeline running through Sudan to the port, right?
Yes, the Southern Sudan port. That's the location of China, where China gets a lot of its oil from Africa. It's a resource-rich country, and a lot of the wealth of that country is sucked up by the oil industry. A little of the wealth sees its way to the people, like in many other countries. But China also has very friendly relations with still remains of Sudan in the northern area. I think something like $700 or $800 million of military weaponry has been sold by China to the Bashir regime since 2010 alone. That's a tremendous amount in just a short period of time for such a cash-strapped country.
So there were these other uprisings, but the current uprising, about when did that start? And what were the things that set it off?
There was, first of all, big protests in 2017 to 2018, again over the price of bread, so almost a year and a half ago. They died down after February or March last year, and then they resurfaced again in December for a much bigger and broader uprising against the government, which had a lot more power behind it. This recent uprising since December has seen many people die in the struggle for democracy and put in jail, tortured, and the government finally did cave in to agree to negotiations in April, I think it was, and then they also arrested the sensible head of the government, al-Bashir, but really it's the same clique of people who are doing the negotiations.
So what are some of the forces involved in this uprising?
The uprising is led by the Sudanese Professional Association, and then there's a Committee for Freedom and Democracy that encompasses a lot more people and organizations. The main negotiations are being led by the Forces for Freedom and Democracy. That group is encompasses women, trade unions, students, professionals, you name it. It's also all the political parties are part of it as well. And this group is able to call on people to have mass demonstrations and civil disobedience and general strikes. So it's really backed by millions and millions of people.
So right now there's a, I think they call it a revolutionary escalation taking place, because the military leaders are refusing to turn the country over to civilian rule. Maybe you can explain a little bit about that.
Well, a revolutionary situation has existed probably since December, and it really is a revolutionary situation, not just a situation where there's a lot of protests. What is the essence of the revolution? It's the demand for civilian rule. That's the main point of agreement by all the organizations, including the Communist Party in Sudan, which plays a very prominent role in the Sudanese Professional Association and also in the Forces for Freedom and Change.
Okay. There was a quite a lengthy article in the New York Times. I sent you a copy of it. Could you sort of go through that article and sort of explain some of the problems with the mass media, what they aren't telling us, and how they're trying to confuse people?
Yeah, well, I noticed, picked out a few things. I didn't expect this, but you're right about the misinformation. First of all, the tone of the article is very pessimistic about the strength of the revolutionary forces in Sudan. They're predicting that it will fail because of the violence by the regime on June 3rd, especially, where the regime committed a major atrocity against a protest camp outside the military headquarters in the capital of Sudan in Khartoum. Really, that's really what the report is about, the de-escalation of the revolution.
The other problem
is that it really elevates the role of the United States in solving Sudan's problems. You know, the big news in this article is that the U.S. is sending one of the top envoys for Africa they have to try to negotiate or to promote the continuation of negotiations between the Forces of Freedom and Change and the military junta that's still ruling the country.
And how are the revolutionary organizations relating to this envoy that's been sent to Sudan?
Well, I'm not sure if this article doesn't refer to any meetings that this envoy had with the Forces for Freedom and Change, nor the results if they did meet. But the fact is that the Forces for Freedom and Change at some point did agree to resume negotiations with the military junta, regardless of the atrocities that it committed. Really, you know, there's a little bit more pressure internationally, a little bit more solidarity, in other words, with the people of Sudan because of the horrible actions of the regime.
They're supposed to put some of the people on trial. How are people responding to that?
That hasn't happened yet. People, it's one of the main demands by the membership of the Forces for Freedom and Change. But so far the regime is admitting that it committed an atrocity, and so therefore it has created an opening for some international diplomatic demands for an investigation by the proper authorities internationally, like the International Criminal Court and so on.
Yeah, has the International Criminal Court sent investigators and stuff to Sudan yet?
Well, not over the recent actions of the junta, but al-Bashir, the deposed president, personally has been charged by the International Criminal Court for his actions, in particular against in a region called Darfur. So the fact that he has not yet been turned over to the ICC is an indication that the military junta is really holding al-Bashir in protective custody to prevent, to rescue him from international justice.
Yeah, plus they probably want to protect themselves too.
Of course, yeah. Well, they're still working, they're still able to travel to different countries and get all the arms and help that they can get. In fact, they're still helping the Saudi Arabian government with about 30,000 troops in Yemen, for which they're paid around $5,000 a month and per soldier, and most of it's pocketed by the powers that be in Sudan, and only about $100 a month is seen for every soldier is seen by the soldier or his family himself.
You've been keeping people pretty up to date on what's going on in Sudan on a Facebook page. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and let people know how they
sure.
can look at your Facebook page.
We started this group on the Facebook called Canadian Campaign for a Democratic Sudan. And right now it's got about 600 or so members, people who actually accepted the idea that they should belong to it, not just were invited. And that's a good number. More than half are from Canada, the second portion of the second most populous country is Sudan itself, followed by Saudi Arabia of all countries and Egypt. These are countries which are heavily involved in backing the regime in Sudan, which is kind of interesting. It shows that the people in Saudi Arabia and Egypt themselves are probably understanding a bit more about what their government is up to than the government really wants them to understand.
And what's happened with the internet? We keep hearing a lot about the military government there has shut down the internet. Is it still shut down or has it opened up?
Yeah. They're doing that, of course, to create trouble for organizing the revolutionary forces within Sudan itself. The terrorist groups that are in Somalia are now coming in to advise the Transitional Military Council, TMC, and they're probably falling under the advice that they're getting from these groups, which are very reactionary, fundamentalist, religious groups. And there's some fear on the part of the revolutionary forces that ISIS might gain another foothold in that country, the way they did in places like Libya and so on, and create a real mess. But almost all the big powers in the world are backing the, or trying to snuff out the revolution.
Yeah, with all these major countries involved in the Sudan, I know here in the United States we get very little news about what's going on. Even the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times hasn't had a lot of news, and what they have really hasn't covered it very accurately. And like you said, they've been promoting a pessimism that the people can prevail. But in Canada, how has the media been treating the situation in Sudan?
At the local level, it's positive. Wherever there are protests, the local media seem to be covering it. We had two TV stations and a good report in one of the dailies here in Winnipeg on a rally that we had two weekends ago, soon after the massacre. And that's true for about two or three other activities like that before, since 2018. So the cross Canada level, though, it's never really made the national news, except for the idea that there's been a massacre or some other horrible act by the military junta. And that's the only time really that people understand that there's something going on in Sudan. There's been some effort to explain things at labor council meetings or in trade unions and so on. I noticed that some of the top trade union officers in this country are following the developments and sometimes posting information about it on social media.
Have
but
any
not
of the
that
unions,
much.
Have any
Go
of the
ahead.
Unions taken positions?
Unfortunately, no. The one exception might be, and I'm trying to search my memory here, is the postal workers. But no other group has done it. Now, there's a lot of work to be done in that area. For example, the main industrial union in this country, Unifor, is in favor of the contract that we have with Saudi Arabia to send light armored vehicles. They're about $13 billion worth to that country, and there's no real restrictions on their use in other countries. So obviously, if they're going to use them internally, they'll use their in Saudi Arabia. It'll free up other light armored vehicles to be used in Yemen and places like that.
Yeah, here in the United States, like the politicians aren't even talking about the situation in Sudan. I think they're sort of embarrassed by it, but they don't want people to begin to talk about it. There's a lot going on in Africa in general that we aren't hearing about. The United States has bases and operations going on in most of the African countries right now, and I think Canada is probably party to some of those things. But what's been the position like of the different parties, the Liberal Party and the Conservatives and the New Democratic Party and the Communist Party in Canada?
Well, you could probably lump the NDP, Liberals, and Conservatives into one group, and the Communist Party in the other camp. We're a pretty small party in the camp in the Communist Party, opposed to Western imperial control, grabbing of Africa. There seems to be another race for Africa, if you will, and that can be determined largely by looking at the not just the money that flows into Africa in terms of investment, but also the military goods that are sold in the continent. If you look at the Stockholm Institute for it's called CPRI anyway. It's a group that studies the arms sales every year. China sells a big portion of its weapons to certain countries, and the Western countries sell certain to other countries. So it's dividing the continent that way, redividing the continent. And these weapons are being used to oppress the working masses of those countries in that continent. There's no, and also further to grab, you know, in certain spheres of influence, one country or another for the purposes of China, for the purposes of the Western imperial, or for the Western imperial powers.
Yeah, I noticed a while back Lloyd Axworthy was speaking in some places here in the United States, and he was pushing for this humanitarian intervention, and he focused a lot on African countries. What has he been doing there in Canada? Is he still pushing that for so-called humanitarian intervention?
Yeah, it's a standard approach since Yugoslavia. He's really there to implement what he calls the responsibility to protect, and all it is it's an excuse by powerful, wealthy countries of the world to declare quite unjustifiably that certain countries are out of control and chaos, and very often the chaos is caused by these Western countries themselves. Who it's an excuse for the powerful countries to reconquer the countries that are really trying to fight for their sovereignty.
Yeah, the imperialism needs these divisions. No matter where these imperialist countries go, they sow divisions among the people. And I don't know, Africa seems to be a place where, you know, we haven't really heard a lot about, because they want to keep people sort of stupid so they can continue to rob the people over there. But I don't know, what are the peace organizations saying about the situation in Sudan there in Canada?
Well, the peace movement is really at a low ebb in Canada. We're unfortunately an imperialist country like the U.S., like France, like Britain, and so on. And idea of having a mass processed movement by in the area of peace and disarmament is well, it's that that idea has been missing for the last about 15 years, since about 2005. That's the last time we really had a big victory by the anti-war disarmament forces. That's when we kept Canada out of ballistic missile defense, that U.S. program, Star Wars. So the peace of it, obviously, as such as it is opposed to it. You know, there are real efforts to renew the peace movement and reactivate it, but so far the protests are still pretty small.
Yeah. So what do you think people can do to, you know, increase their support for the people of Sudan right now?
Oh, I think the key group to get mobilized in international solidarity is the trade union movement. And in that case, there's got to be not just Canadian trade unions backing this effort to be in solidarity with the people of Sudan for the sovereignty of Sudan and so on. It's got to be more of a global approach to all the trade unions through, for example, the International Confederation of Trade Unions or the World Federation of Trade Unions. If there can be a more of a global look at Sudan, that would be really beneficial. Because Sudan is really a prime example of perhaps, you know, it is the weak link in the chain of imperialism that might start the whole ball rolling to roll up imperialism strength and put really set imperialism back.
So far, there hasn't been a real interest shown by the unions here in this country either, and the peace movement hasn't really mentioned the situation in Sudan. And it's I don't know, it's really hard to get any information at all other than, you know, what you've been publishing. And so
yeah.
Maybe you can give your link again for your Facebook page again.
Sure. It's the Canadian Campaign for a Democratic Sudan. We put the number 2018 after it to indicate the year it was established.
Okay. Do you want to give a telephone number where people can contact you if they want to get involved?
Sure, yeah. Anytime they want to phone me up and maybe get a sample or resolution, a solidarity resolution for their union or something, they can phone me. It's 204-792-3371.
Do you have a sample resolution there with you?
Yeah, it's at the top of the Facebook page. I don't have it right in front of me.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it indicates that organization endorsing the resolution is calling for the immediate release of all political prisoners for the respect of Sudan's sovereignty in the case of democratic change in the country, and solidarity with the people of Sudan.
Does anybody know
three main areas?
Does anybody know how many political prisoners exist in Sudan right now?
Right now, there were thousands arrested after the July 3rd massacre. Many more were injured and so on and that. And in essence, if once they're released from hospital, they quite often get arrested too. So it's in the, I don't know if they've been released recently, but there's been hundreds and hundreds of people arrested since December.
Yeah.
They were all released, by the way. A lot of them were released when Bashir was arrested in April, but that only lasted for about a month.
So then have some of those people that were released been rearrested?
Almost certainly. the people went underground after the massacre on July 3rd, even though there was a call for the general strike. Was respected. The call for a general strike was respected by millions of people right across the country. The main city to worry about is Khartoum. That's where the Janjaweed forces, the most reactionary arm of the regime, is controlling the streets. All the other cities in Sudan are really able to protest quite freely. So there's a weakness in the regime itself, that its base is in Khartoum itself, but also the revolution is largely based in the capital city as well.
So, the revolution is really going on in even the small villages and stuff, right?
Yeah, that's true. The call for a general strike was respected in almost all the regions of the country, the ports, the main regions, the agricultural regions, the countryside. Even the poor peasants were protesting.
Yeah. And this professional organization, can you describe that a little bit?
Well, they've been striking quite often. They're adopting the tactics of the trade union movement, calling general strikes and so on. They're able to do that because they're better paid. There's some concern that the poor paid workers in Sudan cannot go out on strike as long as the professionals. But the trade unions themselves were banned by al-Bashir. One of the big demands by some elements within the Forces for Freedom and Change is to reestablish the trade unions. Informally, they're part of the Sudanese Professional Association. So there's some continuity of those trade unions through the SPA. So that it really is a working class organization in the broadest sense. It encompasses the professionals, the doctors, the lawyers, even jurists are part of it. It's quite an extensive array of working people, government workers, you name it.
What about the religious community? You mentioned the more reactionary religious community. Is there a progressive religious community?
There are some, definitely, but religion matters very little to the current protesters. They now are more aware that the government and religion are two separate things. It used to be a big basis of al-Bashir's strength, the dictator who governed Sudan for 30 years. The fundamentalists were a big base of his strength. And their influence on young people was very key. But in recent years, the people who have traveled back to Sudan have been telling me that the young people no longer respect the fundamentalists, especially their role in government. So they quite often don't go to their schools. They're very disrespectful to the fundamentalist forces if they ever raise a political demand of any kind. So really these demands and protests are really separate from any role that the fundamentalists have played in the last 30 years.
So poverty must be a major issue with the people, right?
Yeah. Well, the condition of working people is the start for any kind of strategy for real change. And people are realizing that the economy is out of control. There's a real economic crisis. Bread prices in particular went up twice, once in 2017, once in 2018, and the second time it went up, each time it was in December. That's when big protests started, and people cannot afford the cost of living anymore.
Like the cost of living, can you explain a little bit about the cost of living in Sudan?
Yeah, I can't remember the figure, but I think it was something like... I'm going off the top of my head. They tripled the price of bread. And that was one of the actual conditions that the International Monetary Fund imposed on Sudan in 2017, that it would have to lift the subsidies on bread or end the subsidies on bread. And that caused the price to increase dramatically. So the price of bread went up into 2017 and in 2018. Inflation was close to 200% as of in February last year, about a year and a few months ago. The International Monetary Fund also forced the devaluation of the currency, which made the assets of the country ripe for the picking by any kind of international investor. So the whole country was really under a lot of duress for at least a year and a half.
So the International Monetary Fund has been imposing austerity in Sudan just like it does in the rest of the world, in Greece and every place else, which is causing a lot of trouble.
Yeah, causing immense hardship on a scale that is really unprecedented in the country, and it's affecting farmers and people within the cities both.
What kind of foreign investments are there in Sudan? What companies, banks?
I think the banking, I'm not sure at all, but there's a lot of indigenous banking capital. It's Comprador capital, dealing with coming out of merchant capital, the trading of goods and services, mainly goods that came out of Sudan off of the international market, i.e. the Western countries. The resource country companies are mainly to do with oil. There's some oil still left in the territory left in the northern part of Sudan. And those companies are both Western and Chinese. Norway is one of the bigger countries that has oil investments in Sudan.
So have you heard anything about how like the people of Norway are responding to what's going on in Sudan?
That's actually a good avenue to pursue in terms of investigation. I hadn't thought about that, but I know the government's been really involved in commenting on the developments in the last year and a half. They've been part of the group that has backed up trying to prop up al-Bashir.
Like one of the problems is that, you know, the main resistance to capitalism and imperialism has been the communist parties for, you know, the last 100 years. And there seems to be a lack of continuity and cooperation between communist parties. I think that's sort of hindering the movement to develop solidarity with the people of Sudan. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that's very notable between the Communist Party of China and the Communist Party of Sudan. I think they're just the level of criticism from the party in Sudan against the Chinese Communist Party it's been pretty muted, I guess, because they understand that they're facing not just the China, which is supplying the regime hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons every year, pretty much, but they're facing U.S. imperialism too, so for them, they don't see too much difference. You know, they really want to get rid of the regime, and
I
whole international communist movement really needs to develop more of a reach, because there have been statements in solidarity with Sudan, like signed by about 50 to 60 different communist and workers parties. And those are significant statements, very accurate and truthful and helpful. But the response that they're getting in the countries around them are not yet that vast. Like, they're not significant. The significant absence, of course, is the Communist Party of China that doesn't sign those statements.
Yeah. I did notice, though, that a couple of weeks ago, the Chinese foreign minister did say that they'll be happy to do business with whoever is in power in Sudan.
So, yes, that's really all that matters to them, is doing business. They're protecting their own business, but in so doing.
Yeah. So at this point, you've got this International Monetary Fund, which is mainly controlled by the United States and the big corporations and Wall Street. So there needs to be some kind of education of what this International Monetary Fund is doing to Sudan and countries all over the world. We got the situation with U.S. bases. We don't even know. American people don't even know where the U.S. has bases in Africa and what kinds of actions they're carrying out. And we don't know until some bodies come back in body bags and then they say, oh, yeah, there's something going on there. And I'm wondering what's going to be going on in Sudan with the U.S. military and with Trump and all these people, Bannon. And I noticed Bannon's been traveling all over the world, including in Canada, whipping up this anti-socialist and anti-communist crusade that he's on. I don't know, is that having any impact in Canada?
Yeah, there was a big debate between him and Paul Frum in Toronto, and there were big protests not to have the debate. So look, people in Canada are alert to the danger of the far right people, forces, including led by Bannon or influenced by Bannon. That was a healthy sign.
Yeah.
There's been a good anti-fascist, anti-alt-right movement starting to take shape in Canada, and that's really it augurs well. There's been serious discussions at the Labour Council in Winnipeg about the need to support these developments.
Well, that's good. And like when we have Bannon now, he's traveling all over the world, though, causing these problems and instigating hate and divisions. And I'm wondering what impact that's having, in Africa, too. We don't hear much about that. I don't know if he's been to Africa. He's been all over Europe. He's been to Hong Kong, and now Hong Kong is having problems. But I wonder how the U.S. government's going to respond to the revolution in Sudan. Is it going to be a socialist revolution, do you think?
No. The revolution has never been called a socialist revolution, even by the Communist Party in Sudan. It can turn into a socialist revolution, just the same way the Russian Revolution turned from a democratic revolution to a socialist revolution in 1917. But that really has to do with how the Western world approaches things. I imagine if Sudan's revolution does take place, democracy is achieved, the forces that are backing the revolution are largely working people, and they will probably have to choose, just like Cuba did, a path of socialism just to stay alive, because the Western economies are not going to help the Sudanese economy, and you need an economy to survive. It'll probably try to strangle the Sudanese country economically.
I don't know, have you been paying attention to the articles in the Wall Street Journal about Sudan?
No, not a bit. No, not the Wall Street Journal, but it's always a worthwhile thing to look at. Just like I've been reading The Economist and things like that.
Yeah, because the Wall Street Journal has been taking sort of an unusual position, and they've almost opposed the government that's in power there in Sudan. But they're not clear about what they want to see as a replacement.
Yeah.
It's like there's this these secret dealings going on with this U.S. envoy and probably corporate interest, and they're trying to figure out what kind of governments they want to impose again in Sudan, and how they're going to oppose the people's demand for democracy. I don't know how that's going to pan out.
Well, the Wall Street Journal is recognizing the political weakness of the regime. It's isolated from the masses of people. Its main support is coming from other countries, not Sudan itself. So they're desperate to put in place a regime that will continue the policies of the Bashir government without really fundamental change that people really want and need. I think the people of Sudan are far ahead of have a way different agenda than the Wall Street Journal does.
Yeah, well, that's pretty obvious. But I'm wondering what the people of Sudan are going to be up against if they do remove this military government that's in power.
It'll be probably another situation like Cuba, where the Western powers will not be too happy with the government in power, and they will work to subvert it. Now, the leadership of such a popular government, a popular revolutionary government, will have to face internal struggles to keep on the path of what the people want, and also they'll have to fight the foreign interference as well. So they're going to be in a tough struggle internally and externally. That's really what they'll need to expect and anticipate.
Because I know, like, even the British government seems to be saying, you know, that this violence has to stop, and is telling the military government that they got to stop, you know, shooting the people down and stop with the repression. So I don't know, the capitalists seem to have their agenda that they're not really talking about. And the Sudanese people, it's hard for them to get out the message of what they're trying to accomplish there in the Sudan. So,
The government obviously, the Western powers, the wealthy and powerful Western powers, they obviously want continuity, not real change. That's the key thing. Like, the Trump administration lifted sanctions that it imposed on Sudan in November of 2017, just before the IMF, when the IMF was making its recommendations to end the subsidy of bread, for example. So all these countries, China and the Western powers, are all helping the existing regime. That's for their real agenda. If you look at their economic agenda, you'll understand their political agenda.
Yeah.
And so far they're trying to cover up their economic agenda of robbery and oppression of Sudan with declarations, meaningless declarations of respect for human rights and an end to the massacres.
Yeah. Yeah, the human rights doesn't really mean anything to the imperialists.
Nope.
So, I don't know, so where do you think the movement is heading towards as far as building solidarity with Sudan? Have you had contact with any people in the United States to discuss what can be done to build some kind of international solidarity?
Only through the Sudanese communities themselves, unfortunately. I haven't really managed to connect with activists on the ground who are from outside the Sudanese communities in the United States. But I'm sure that, there's so many other issues like Venezuela and so on where there are active movements that the radar will eventually settle on, of these movements will eventually settle on Sudan also. I'm confident about that. Right now it's not on the radar, probably because Venezuela is a lot closer at hand. And so I'm not too worried about that. Also, the fact is that Africa as a whole is becoming more and more an occupied territory by the United States, as you mentioned, militarily. And sooner or later, that's going to backfire as well, with direct involvement of the United States being exposed more and more. This whole system is reaching a level of deception and oppression and crushing hardship for people. It's at a stage where it cannot really continue to exist in the same form that it is right now. So it could be war, it could be some kind of uprising, it could be a positive or a negative thing, but the news will not stop.
Yeah. What's the African Union's position been on all this?
Well, they couldn't hold their nose anymore, so they finally made more and more declarations, and they've cast out Sudan from membership in the African Union after the June 3rd massacre. Before, they had given the transitional military government somewhat of an extensive timeline, 3 months I think it was, to transfer power to civilians. And that was where they became very intransigent and refused to negotiate the turnover, change of power.
What kind of support has the revolutionary movement received from other African governments?
Well, I've been trying to search, for example, what the South African Communist Party has been saying, because there's two parties that are really powerful on the African continent. It's the South African Communist Party and the Sudanese Communist Party. These are two parties that have been through the ringer over the last 30, 40 years, even 60, 70 years going back. So, but I have yet to really see Sudan as an important issue in South Africa itself, which says something about the nature of politics in South Africa too. It's more inward looking than outward looking. Just the same way politics in Canada is, and politics in perhaps any powerful imperialist country is.
Yeah. So the Sudanese communities, I know there's a small Sudanese community in Minneapolis, and I've worked with some people from Sudan, and they were real hesitant to talk about things that were going on. I think that's a big problem. They feel that they're being watched and looked at by the FBI and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I don't know how it is in the U.S., but in Canada, there's been a few cities like Winnipeg where they're not afraid at all. We've been protesting at the constituency offices of prominent cabinet ministers up here quite regularly, and the Manitoba legislature. They're looking constantly to develop new ways to keep the actions going. In fact, I just had a message coming from the Sudanese community now that they want to have a weekly protest at different locations throughout Winnipeg from now until the success of the revolution. So these are determined people. I mean, and it varies from city to city, I'm sure. Maybe in the U.S. there's more of fear of deportation and so on, but there are some voices in the U.S. Congress that have said things along the lines of, you know, the need for human rights and general declarations of goodness and niceness in Sudan. So, I mean, politically, it would be difficult to crack down on the Sudanese community even in the United States.
Okay. With you were talking about the Labor Council there in Winnipeg. Have they taken a position at all?
Yes, there was a resolution in early 2018 in solidarity with the people of Sudan and for the immediate release of political prisoners. It was moved by a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 832. The president of the Labor Council is was invited to several protest rallies in solidarity, but was unable to attend just for different reasons. But her, you know, I know that the heart of the president was in this, and I can count on the fact that the solidarity will continue to develop and strengthen.
Okay. In this one paragraph in this article here from the New York Times, they talk about the public employees who have joined the strike.
Yeah.
Are they a big factor in this whole protest movement?
Well, it shows that the more educated sections of the working class are with the revolution, that the regime that is in power right now cannot count on their loyalty. But at the same time, the fact that the government saw who was part of the general strike when they went out, they are somewhat exposed and more liable to a crackdown, just the same way any kind of public sector worker would be if they went out on strike in
so
any other country.
Yeah, what it says is public employees who have joined the strike will probably be punished aggressively. Now, what do they mean when they say punished aggressively?
They could be jailed. They could be tortured. They could be murdered, disappeared. The people in power right now are counting more and more on the more violent sections of the state security apparatus in Sudan, the one that al-Bashir used to commit war crimes in places like Darfur, so that those forces have moved from Darfur into the city of the capital city of Khartoum. It's a pretty violent situation. These are people who really committed horrible atrocities on June 3rd. And they're gaining power within the regime itself, obviously. The regime is relying on these cutthroats more and more.
Okay. It says that the United Nations, have they abandoned Sudan?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, there's top officials within the United Nations who have condemned the atrocity on June 3rd, but then at the same time, the regime and the protests have not really factored in to be such a big item on the agenda of the United Nations before June 3rd. So the June 3rd massacre really did serve to draw attention to the crimes of the government and the revolution itself, which is there's a silver lining in that. You know, the horrible massacre did lead to attention and condemnation of the regime.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end of the program. We'll need to keep in touch with you about this to keep people informed, because there's very little real information that people are getting here in the United States. So what you've been publishing is real helpful, and I appreciate you coming on the program. We appreciate this.
Well, it's a pleasure being on this program. I wish you great, good success for your future programs as well.
Okay, talk to you later, Daryl.
Thanks
for being on.
Bye.
Yep, bye.
And you can listen to Stuart Alexander's program, Left of Liberal, Socialist Can, 1 Hour Left, on Wednesday. We'll be on, there'll be some subjects we'll be discussing. Each panel member will discuss different subjects. We're not sure what they are at this point yet, but listen to us then, and listen to us Monday at the same time, 7 p.m. Central. Thank you.
Yep, thanks for joining us.